Chapter 34. Touching, and Tony thought over and over again how handsome Anna was. He spoke tenderer and tenderer, and called her ear Anna in a whisper at last. "You've settled it with Millie by this time, I suppose," said she. "And no, not exactly."
"What?
How low you talk, Tony." "Yes, I've a kind of hoarseness." I said, "not exactly."
"I suppose you mean to?"
"Well, as to that," his eyes rested on her face, and hers on his. He wondered how he could have been such a fool as not to follow up Anna.
"Why, sweet Anna,"
he bursts out, taking her hand, not being really able to help it, and forgetting Millie and Unity, and all the world besides.
"Edled it?
I don't think I have."
"Hark,"
says Anna.
"What?"
says Tony, letting go her hand. "Surely I heard a sort of little screaming squeak under those sacks?
Why, you've been carrying corn, and there's mice in this wagon, I declare."
She began to haul up the tails of her gown.
"Oh no, 'tis the axle," said Tony in an assuring way.
"Tea do go like that sometimes in dry weather."
"Perhaps it was.
Well, now, to be quite honest, dear Tony, do you like her better than me?
Because, although I've held off so independent, I'll own at last that I do like E, Tony, to tell the truth. And I wouldn't say no, if you ask me you know what."
Tony was so won over by this pretty offering mood of a girl who had been quite the reverse, Anna had a backward way with her at times, if you can mind, that he just glanced behind, and then whispered very soft, "I haven't quite promised her, and I think I can get out of it, and ask you that question you speak of.
Throw over Millie, all to marry me.
How delightful," broke out Anna, quite loud, clapping her hands. At this there was a real squeak, an angry, spiteful squeak, and afterward a long moan, as if something had broke its heart, and a movement of the empty sacks.
"Something's there,"
said Anna, starting up.
"It's nothing, really," says Tony in a soothing voice, and praying inwardly for a way out of this.
"Wouldn't tell E at first, because I wouldn't frighten E. But, Anna, I've really a couple of ferrets in a bag under there, for rabbiting, and they quarrel sometimes.
I don't wish it knowed, as 'twould be called poaching.
Oh, they can't get out, bless ye, you are quite safe.
And what a fine day it is, isn't it, Anna, for this time of year.
Be you going to market next Saturday? How is your aunt now?"
And so on, says Tony, to keep her from talking any more about love in Millie's hearing.
But he found his work cut out for him, and wondering again how he should get out of this ticklish business, he looked about for a chance. Nearing home he saw his father in a field not far off, holding up his hand, as if he wished to speak to Tony.
"Would you mind taking the reins a moment, Anna?" he said, much relieved,
"while I go and find out what father wants?"
She consented, and away he hastened into the field, only too glad to get breathing time. He found that his father was looking at him with rather a stern eye.
Come, Tony," says old Mr. Kites, as soon as his son was alongside him, "this won't do, you know."
"What?"
says Tony.
"Why, if you mean to marry Millie Richards, do it, and there's an end dot. But don't go driving about the country with Jolliver's daughter and making a scandal.
I won't have such things done.
I only asked her, that is, she asked me, to ride home."
"She?
Why, now, if it had been Millie, 'twould have been quite proper. But you and Anna Jolliver going about by yourselves, Millie's there too, father."
"Millie?
Where?"
"Under the corn sacks."
"Yes, the truth is, father, I've got rather into a nunny watch, I'm afeard.
Unity Salad is there too, yes, at the other end, under the tarpaulin.
All three are in that wagon, and what to do with them, I know no more than the dead.
The best plan is, as I'm thinking, to speak out loud and plain to one of them before the rest, and that will settle it. Not but what 'twill cause them to kick up a bit of a miff, for certain. Now which would you marry, father, if he was in my place?"
"Whichever of them did not ask to ride with thee." That was Millie, I'm bound to say, as she only mounted by my invitation. But Millie, then stick to Millie, she's the best. Dot dot, but look at that. His father pointed toward the wagon. He can't hold that horse in. You shouldn't have left the reins in her hands. Run on and take the horse's head, or there'll be some accident to the mates. Tony's horse, in fact, in spite of Anna's tugging at the reins, had started on his way at a brisk walking pace, being very anxious to get back to the stable, for he had had a long day out. Without another word, Tony rushed away from his father to overtake the horse. Now of all things that could have happened to wean him from Millie, there was nothing so powerful as his father's recommending her. No, it could not be Millie, after all. Anna must be the one, since he could not marry all three. This he thought, while running after the wagon. But queer things were happening inside it. It was, of course, Millie who had screamed under the sackbags, being obliged to let off her bitter rage and shame in that way at what Tony was saying, and never daring to show, for very pride, and dread of being laughed at, that she was in hiding. She became more and more restless, and in twisting herself about, what did she see but another woman's foot and white stocking close to her head? It quite frightened her, not knowing that Unity Sallet was in the wagon likewise. But after the fright was over, she determined to get to the bottom of all this, and she crept along the bed of the wagon, under the tarpaulin, like a snake, when lo and behold she came face to face with Unity. Well, if this isn't disgraceful, says Millie in a raging whisper to Unity. Tis, says Unity, to see you hiding in a young man's wagon like this, and no great character belonging to either of ye. Mind what you are saying, replied Millie, getting louder. I'm engaged to be married to him, and haven't I a right to be here? What right have you, I should like to know? What has he been promising you? A pretty lot of nonsense, I expect. But what Tony says to other women is all mere wind, and no concern to me. Don't you be too sure, says Unity. He's going to have Anna, and not you, nor me either. I could hear that. Now at these strange voices sounding from under the cloth, Anna was thunderstruck amidst into a swound, and it was just at this time that the horse moved on. Anna tugged away wildly, not knowing what she was doing, and as the quarrel rose louder and louder, Anna got so horrified that she let go the reins altogether. The horse went on at his own pace, and coming to the corner where we turned round to drop down the hill to Lower Long Puddle, he turned too quick, the off wheels went up the bank, the wagon rose sideways till it was quite on edge upon the near axles, and out rolled the three maidens into the road in a heap. When Tony came up, frightened and breathless, he was relieved enough to see that neither of his darlings was hurt, beyond a few scratches from the brambles of the hedge. But he was rather alarmed when he heard how they were going on at one another. Don't ye quarrel, my dears, don't ye, says he, taking off his hat out of respect to em. And then he would have kissed them all round, as fair and square as a man could, but they were in too much of a taking to let him, and screeched and sobbed till they was quite spent. Now I'll speak out honest, because I ought to, says Tony, as soon as he could get heard. Indeed this is the truth, says he. I've asked Anna to be mine, and she is willing, and we are going to put up the banns next. Tony had not noticed that Anna's father was coming up behind, nor had he noticed that Anna's face was beginning to bleed from the scratch of a bramble. Anna had seen her father, and had run to him, crying worse than ever. My daughter is not willing, sir, says Mr. Jolliver, hot and strong. Be you willing, Anna? I ask ye to have spirit enough to refuse him, if e'er virtue is left to ye, and you run no risk. She's as sound as a bell for me, that I'll swear, says Tony, flaring up. And ye so's the others, come to that, though you may think it an unusual thing in me. I have spirit, and I do refuse him, says Anna, partly because her father was there, and partly too, in a tantrum, because of the discovery, and the scratch on her face. Little did I think when I was so soft with him just now that I was talking to such a false deceiver.
What, you won't have me, Hannah? Says Tony, his jaw hanging down like a dead man's.
Never, I would sooner marry no nobody at all, she gasped out, though with her heart in her throat, for she would not have refused Tony if he had asked her quietly, and her father had not been there, and her face had not been scratched by the bramble. And having said that, away she walked upon her father's arm, thinking and hoping he would ask her again. Tony didn't know what to say next. Millie was sobbing her heart out, but as his father had strongly recommended her, he couldn't feel inclined that way. So he turned to Unity.
Well, will you, Unity dear, be mine, he says.
Take her leavings?
Not I, says Unity.
Descorn it. And away walks Unity Salad likewise, though she looked back, when she'd gone some way, to see if he was following her. So there at last, were left Millie and Tony by themselves, she crying in watery streams, and Tony looking like a tree struck by lightning.
Well, Millie, he says at last, going up to her, it do seem as if fate had ordained that it should be you and I, or nobody.
And what must be, I suppose.
Hey, Millie? If you like, Tony.
You didn't really mean what you said to them?
Not a word of it,
declares Tony, bringing down his fist upon his palm.
And then he kissed her, and put the wagon to rights, and they mounted together, and their banns were put up the very next Sunday. I was not able to go to their wedding, but it was a rare party they had, by all account. Everybody in Longpuddle was there almost. You among the rest, I think, Mr. Flaxton?
The speaker turned to the parish clerk.
I was, said Mr. Flaxton.
And that party was the cause of a very curious change in some other people's affairs. I mean in Steve Hardcomes and his cousin James.
The Hardcomes, said the stranger.
How familiar that name is to me.
What of them?
The clerk cleared his throat and began.
The history of the Hardcomes.
Yes, Tony's was the very best wedding Randy that ever I was at, and I've been at a good many, as you may suppose, turning to the newly arrived one having as a church officer the privilege to attend all christening, wedding, and funeral parties, such being our Wessex custom. 'Twas on a frosty night in Christmas week, and among the folk invited were the said Hardcomes O'Climmerston, Steve and James' first cousins, both of them small farmers, just entering into business on their own account. With them came, as a matter of course, their intended wives, two young women of the neighborhood, both very pretty and sprightly maidens, and numbers of friends from Abbott's Cernel, and Weatherbury, and Millstock, and I don't know where a regular houseful. The kitchen was cleared of furniture for dancing, and the old folk played at it, and LL4s in the parlor, though at last they gave that up to join in the dance. The top of the figure was by the large front window of the room, and there were so many couples that the lower part of the figure reached through the door at the back and into the darkness of the outhouse. In fact, you couldn't see the end of the row at all, and 'twas never known exactly how long that dance was, the lowest couples being lost among the faggots and brushwood in the outhouse. When we had danced a few hours, and the crowns of we taller men were swelling in two lumps with bumping the beams of the ceiling, the first fiddler laid down his fiddle bow, and said he should play no more, for he wished to dance. And in another hour the second fiddler laid down his, and said he wanted to dance too. So there was only the third fiddler left, and he was a old, veteran man, very weak in the wrist. However, he managed to keep up a faltering tweedledee, but there being no chair in the room, and his knees being as weak as his wrists, he was obliged to sit upon as much of the little corner table as projected beyond the corner cupboard fixed over it, which was not a very wide seat for a man advanced in years. Among those who danced most continually were the two engaged couples, as was natural to their situation. Each pair was very well matched, and very unlike the other. James Hardcomb's intended was called Emily Darth, and both she and James were gentle, nice-minded, adore people, fond of a quiet life. Steve and his chosen, named Olive Pale, were different. They were of a more bustling nature, fond of racketing about and seeing what was going on in the world. The two couples had arranged to get married on the same day, and that not long thence, Tony's wedding being a sort of stimulant, as is often the case, I've noticed it professionally many times. They danced with such a will as only young people in that stage of courtship can dance, and it happened that as the evening wore on, Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.